All right, shall we? So, this guy in the funny-looking hat looks unfamiliar to most of you. This is Jordan. We always give previous residents a backdoor pass anytime they want to. Okay, so. You're good. Steve Jobs says 5:59. So, from his grave, he says you're okay. I know the right thing to do right now. However, good luck, buddy. Somebody wanted you to be on time. Well, you owe them a thank you letter, so. All right, we'll give you a pass on that one, so. Anyway, so this is Jordan Williams. Jordan went through 2 years ago? Yeah, good night, dude. Crazy. So if you guys ever see random residents popping in, that's why. So if they're crazy enough to come rejoin us. Jared, who's one of our seminarians, went through last year, and he's doing the whole thing again, which I don't know if my teaching was that bad that he didn't catch any of this, or he just has a death wish, or I don't know. So, but anyway, so he's going to actually hear it twice. So anyway, that's Jordan. By the way, it'd be good for you guys to just maybe meet some of them. I'm going to bring in Ben and Sonny Drury, if you've met them. Ben is a drummer at the Clovis campus. Sonny and the two of them go there. I'm going to have them come just talk about their Israel experience. They had to fundraise double what all of you were fundraising and did it. And they didn't have two nickels to rub together when they started. Okay, so just to give you guys a shot in the arm of encouragement and some ideas of, like, listen, they've done it, and their mountain was twice as high to climb, and God was faithful to them. So they're going to come in probably the next few weeks and just give you guys some experience, some ideas. So as you guys are friends with or know previous residents, it'd be great for you guys just to get time with them, ask them stuff like that. You know, they've been through the drill. They know the test at the end, though they won't give you answers, or they better not. Yes, that's, if you're not sure in the New Testament, answer that. That doesn't work so well in the Old. Sometimes. Who is the pre-incarnate Christ? Jesus, yes. So that one will get you like half points, but we'll see. Cool. How about a proverb, shall we? 27:18. Let's go there. So I gave you a nugget yesterday on responsibility, faithfulness, how to be a great employee. Here is part two, okay? Not something you always see exalted, at least outside of Scripture, but this is a concept that will get you far in numerous stages of life. Also included in that would be the employee-employer world. Somebody read 27:18.
Whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who guards his master will be honored.
All right, okay, so we live in an agrarian society here, so we understand this. He who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit, right? You spend time investing in something else outside of yourself, the fig tree. You prune it, you harvest it, you water it, you take care of it, you make sure that it is top-notch throughout the year. What blessing do you get at the end of it? You get to eat the fruit, right? You get the spoils of your labors, okay? The same can be said of part two. He who cares for his master will be honored. Now, in a normal everyday life and workforce, is the theology of most people or their worldview to be outside of themselves and to care for someone else more than themselves? No, it's a me world, it's take care of myself, it's do my job, look out for my promotions. That's not how Scripture approaches this. It says, listen, you need to care for the ones around you, your master specifically, your boss, in a way that, I mean, your whole job is to make them look great, okay? Our pastor used to say back in Texas, whose program I went through, he said, your first job, your first outside of seminary experience, you make your boss, whether it be in the work world or seminary, if it's in the work world, go make him a ton of money or go make her a ton of money. Your job is to make them look great. You stay in the shadows and you exalt them, you serve them, you do whatever you need to do to make them look great. And if that's on a church staff, you serve them. Obviously, you're not going to make them money per se, but you exalt them and you make sure that your job is to support and encourage and do whatever it is they need you to do. And then from that will come all the fruits of that labor, right? Rewards, promotions, whatever it may be, moving up the corporate ladder. That's a great perspective on it, okay? He who cares for his master will be honored. Now, can you think of, biblically, people that remained outside of maybe the limelight and because they did such a great job of honoring their master were promoted almost instantaneously? Who do you think of when that comes to mind? Old Testament characters. Joseph, absolutely, right? Serves in Potiphar's house, doesn't share Potiphar's belief system, was such a trustworthy guy that he literally got handed the keys to the jail and said, man, you're in charge of everything. I trust you. As a fellow prisoner, do whatever seems necessary. Ultimately, is the right-hand guy to Pharaoh, right? Who else? How about Daniel? How about a guy that said, listen, Nebuchadnezzar, you're weird, okay? I don't believe in your belief system. I'm not going to eat your food, but I will be the best servant among everybody. He was an import, right, during the captivity. He was brought in from Israel into Babylon, was a blue chip. So the guy said, man, it looks like you've got some talent. Let's see what it looks like. And he said, test me, right? With his buddies Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those guys instantaneously were exalted because of their work ethic, right? Now, some of you have bosses like I do, right, that are great, that are godly. You get to go to work every day and think, man, I am very thankful for the boss that I have. It's very, very easy to serve them because they're great, okay? They love Jesus. They're not perfect, but for the most part, they're good, right? Others of you work for non-Christian bosses that you just as soon strangle and, right, in your dreams at night, you wake up and go, oh, God, you know, what am I doing? It's a little bit more difficult. The challenge is still the same, right? To serve them unconditionally, okay? And there's obviously a point within a workforce where if you can't do that with integrity and the work situation is so bad that, you know, you can't. But the principle is the same. Be a servant, okay? Those are the type of people that get exalted, okay? Team players are hard to find, right? People that truly have the interest of the team as a higher interest than that of their own goals or own career paths. In this day and age, and always has been, those are difficult people to find. And if you find them, I promise you, you will exalt them. And if you are one of them, you will be exalted. Financially, positionally, whatever it may be, your efforts will not go unnoticed. Okay? So thoughts on that from you guys that are in the work world. It's just like you're Jordan. They're like, all right, Genesis, maybe we can wow you with something else this morning. That was all that I had. That was my 98-mile-an-hour fastball. Nothing. All right, Jordan, pray for us, will you?
Yeah.
And then we'll jump in.
Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for allowing all of us, mostly, to gather together collectively and be able to read your scriptures. And I pray that your Holy Spirit would make clarity to each one of us, Lord, and that
amen. All right. So we are in the middle of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's going to get uglier before it gets better, okay? And it's not so good right now. So we are watching the downfall of Lot and the recourse, I guess, of his decisions. Okay, we watched him start his life outside of Sodom. They get sucked into Sodom and then now in the city gates and a position of leadership. We're watching now the aftermath of now the angels coming into town, the city being, we're about to see it get destroyed. And we're watching, obviously, the horrible moral conditions that are part and parcel to Sodom, okay? So we finished in 16-ish, right, of chapter 19. Lot trying to get out, getting basically forced out by the angels. And he hesitates, he with his family, and he gets drug outside the city before God rains hail and flaming fastballs from heaven upon it. Okay, so let's pick up there. Let's kind of watch this story end, and we'll see the aftermath of it. Okay, so chapter 19 is going to end. Boy, you talk about a low point in the book of Genesis. We are in it. Okay, so here's Lot, verse 16. He and his wife and his kids hesitate to leave. It says that the Lord was upon him and brought them outside the city. Verse 17, it came about when they had brought them outside that one said, "Escape for your life, do not look behind you." Lot doesn't want to leave. You guys remember where he wants to go? What was the name of that town? Zoar, okay? Again, Sodom and Gomorrah, south side of the Dead Sea. Okay, Zoar would have been just to the left, like northeast, not very far away, but not up into the mountains yet, right? He did not want to flee into the mountains of Moab. We had a, just kind of a saying our year, Zoar became a kind of a picture for something maybe even more spiritual, right? Lot's out of Sodom, right, which is like the big sin, but he wants to stay close to Sodom. So it's kind of like the little sin. I don't want to flee all the way to the mountains to where I'm gone from it. I want to stay close to sin. I just want to play with it. And we would tell, you know, it was, we had an all-guys group, so it was a very different dynamic in the room than with ladies, which is why we brought in you ladies, because it's much better with you here. So thank you. So it's much less locker room and much more spiritual. And it smells better, too, so thank you. We appreciate that. But we just talked about that concept of little sin, right? You know, on a scale from 1 to 10, boy, if 10's falling off the cliff, Zoar is like you're 1, 2, 3, 4, right? You may not be nose deep in it, but you're moving that way. And we talked about the idea of, man, just stay out of Zoar as well, right? Lot just couldn't refrain himself from stepping into those things, and that's what he wanted. So oddly enough, he's going to get his request, okay? So the angels say, you know what, if that's what you want, then you can have him, okay? So he goes down, and he stays in this place called Zoar, up in like foothills, basically, but it's not up into the mountains yet, okay? So verse 21, he gets granted that request. 22, the angels tell him, hurry, escape there, and he goes to Zoar, okay? 24, let's watch what happens now to Sodom and Gomorrah. Somebody pick up there.
The sun had risen on earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the city and what grew on the ground.
Now just think about that. Like, we haven't seen anything like that. You can imagine in their day and age, like maybe post-flood with Noah, what a thunderstorm looked like and some lightning. Like, that had to wig them out a little bit. Can you imagine flaming hailstones from heaven, localized, not like Fresno, like all over. Like, this was one small city. And Abraham, as he's sitting up in, you know, Mamre, up the hill in Hebron, is watching, you know, this distant cloud or whatever, with flaming whatever coming out of it. What a weird picture. So you talk about a pretty clear judgment from God. What was in the description in whatever chapter it was, 18? Sinners, evil sinners, wickedly, whatever against, like there were like three or four adjectives that get used to describe Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a rough place. And we obviously have seen the full extent of the sin of that place. So here it is, totally destroyed. However, his wife, and Lot and their kids get pulled out. Okay, problem is with his wife. This is an interesting little verse. Read 26 there. Keep going.
But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt.
Okay, so there is a belief in Israel, and we'll drive by it as we go there, that Lot's wife, we don't know her name. She's just called Lot's wife. Okay, that's her heritage in Scripture. Looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. Okay, on the west-hand side of the Dead Sea, as we drive south into the Negev one day, Ronan will point out there's like a little rock formation up in the cliffs that looks like that's just the tradition that's Lot's wife, okay? It looks like maybe a person. It's not, okay? But there is a tradition that roots back to this verse that they think that's what happened, okay? So for whatever reason, God turns into a pillar of salt. That, I believe, if that rock formation, I'm not sure that's it. So anyway, fascinating. So she looks back. Why is she looking back? Yeah, I kind of like that lifestyle, right? So that's the idea that her heart is still there. She's out of the city physically, but that's where she wants to be along with her husband. Okay, so you get an idea of where Lot and his wife are at spiritually. Okay, and then the contrast, right? 27, here's the sitcom. You're watching one scene and immediately it changes. Now we're back to Abraham. And just look at this contrast between what's going on with Lot and what's going on with Abraham. Somebody pick up in 27.
And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord.
they looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the lamp went up like smoke of a furnace.
So here's Abraham rolling out his tent, right? Got his folders in one hand. He's at the place where he last walked with God. He's at peace. He's prayed for Lot, right? And here he is, walks outside, and now sees the destruction of the city, right? Now, what is he thinking right now? Man, I hope I didn't lose Lot. I hope my prayers were heard by God. You know, I started at 50. We got God all the way down to 10. I'm not sure that he's going to find 10, but I don't know what happened with Lot, right? So, but here he is, just at peace, trusting God, and look what God says about Abraham's prayer in verse 29.
So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the city in which Lot had lived.
Man, how cool is that? God remembered Abraham, right? Talk to me about prayer. I mean, translate this into our language today. What does that mean? Absolutely, right? No doubt. God hears us when we pray. This little puny one dude on an earth full of bazillions of people today, does God hear your individual, tiny, petty, at times, prayers? Yes. You know, God, do you really care about my day-to-day life? Do you really care about, you know, the small itty-bitty things? He does, right? Now, not that Lot is insignificant or the life of somebody is insignificant, but God hears Abraham's prayers. Not just hears. What else? His prayers cause God to do something. Think about that, right? This guy's prayers, this one dude, when he prays in faith to a God that he can do, that knows that he can do anything, he is the tendon that's moving the hand of God, right? God is somehow moved to do something on behalf of Abraham, because it certainly wasn't Lot and Lot's righteousness that caused God to go, man, I need to save that guy because he's impressive, right? God, because of what Abraham did, is moved to action, right? Does that not encourage you a little bit about our prayers? Now, it's not to say that God couldn't do that. It's not to say that, I don't know what would have happened had Abraham not prayed, but God chose to include Abraham in the process. And part of his moving was getting Abraham to fall on his face, to pray to him, to have this gut-level, honest, right, real conversation with him, and to express where he was at. And in the midst of that, that was part of the equation that caused God to move, okay? So be encouraged in your prayer life. Like, I don't know about you guys, but there are times that I feel like I'm looking at a ceiling when I'm laying in bed thinking, Lord, really? Like, are you there? Do you care? Is this do anything, right? I'm uninspired to pray or whatever, and you know, I'm around folks around the world that are just incredible, have incredible faith and pray like crazy, and you can see it oozing out of their pores. And man, there are times that I just feel not that way. And there's days that I feel like I should. And it's texts like this to remind me that, man, God cares and he makes a difference. And how many times is God wanting to move, but he's waiting on me to be a part of that equation? He doesn't need me, but maybe he wants to include me in that process before he's going to move. I don't know. So just some thoughts on prayer. Clearly, Abraham's prayers make a difference. Not just God hears them, he's like, okay, check, good job, okay? You get a Jolly Rancher today. He does something on behalf of what Abraham does, okay? So pretty cool. Now, you get Abraham walking with God. He's praying. God moves. However, verse 30, back to Lot, okay? That beautiful, serene lake of the sitcom is gone. Now we're back in Zoar. So let's watch what happens. All right, so apparently the destruction was so great, Lot wanted to get a little bit further away, okay? And apparently all that's left now is Lot and his two daughters, okay? So the two daughters from the story that he was going to send out into the city, okay, those two. So where their husbands are, we don't know, okay? So tell me what type of family they're raised in that verse 31 would sound like a good idea.
Like, oh, wow. Like,
So you get the idea that obviously they're isolated. Now, clearly they're not the only people around, but in their perspective, this was their only option, okay? We're going to all die. We have no husbands, so we can't continue our line. The only male around is Dad. Let's get him hammered and have him sleep with us so that we can have children. Okay, I told you, it gets ugly, right? This is a rough chapter, okay? That's their idea, and that seemed to them like a good idea, okay? Come, let our father drink wine. He'll preserve our line. Verse 33, they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose, okay? Okay, there it is. It's an ugly chapter. So that is how night one goes. Night two, okay, verse 34, came about in the morning. The firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with our father. Let us make him drunk again tonight. Then you can go and lie with him, and that we may preserve our family through our father. So they do the same thing. The second night, they made their father drink wine. In verse 35, he did not know when she rose or when she lay down. And now we've had two daughters that have been impregnated by their father. Okay, verse 36, thus Lot, both daughters of Lot were with child by their fathers. Now look at the two nations that come from this incestuous relationship between dad and daughters. The firstborn son, verse 37, was called Moab, the Moabites. Okay, verse 38, for the younger, the Ben Ami is his name. They are the tribe of Ammon or the Ammonites. So what two people groups come from them? We get the Moabites and the Ammonites. Now, how do they do with Israel? Not so good, right? These are the folks that live on the east side of the Jordan River, okay? So we talked about the mountains of Moab. The Moabites live over there, as well as the Ammonites just south of them, okay? So this is the beginning of a nation. You can imagine when a nation starts this way, it's kind of destructive and not good from the beginning, okay? So just think about, take a step back, and obviously this is awful, and I don't want to necessarily dive into this. It's horrible, but Scripture records it for us, so it's here. Think about Lot's life. This is the last we hear of him, by the way, in Lot in the Bible. That's it, okay? His life started with a great promise. You know, he was underneath the shelter of Uncle Abraham and was journeying and walking with God and had a moment in his life where everything was a fork in the road, where Abraham said, choose. And from that point on, every decision that Lot made sucked him further and further into the Death Star. And at the end of his life, here he is, in a cave, hungover, slept with both of his daughters. He's lost his integrity. He's lost his witness. He's lost everything in his life. And this is the end of Lot, all right? One decision where he looked with his eyes and picked a piece of land, right? Do you think Lot ever looked up and said, this is where my life is going to end? 400 decisions from this one, this is where I'm going to end up, right? Lot probably never thought about that. He simply looked at the land and said, man, there's an opportunity to make money. That looks wise. That's a good area for me to raise cattle or whatever it is, and I'm going to go there, okay? But as you fast forward the picture, this is the consequence. This is the outflow of those decisions. And it ends in a horrible, horrible place, right? And Abraham, if you go back to that same decision, you would say, man, that's not wise for you to choose second. You're the older, you're the uncle. Why would you give him priority, especially knowing what type of guy he is? He's not going to be a servant to you. He's not going to give you the better land. That's not Lot's character. But he says, you know what? I trust God. So the two decisions that you look at in a very small deal, you would say, no, I'd rather be in Lot's seat, right? I would want control of that situation. And Abraham says, nope. But fast forward that now, 10 years, and look where they've ended up. Abraham's walking outside of his tent, at peace with God, drinking coffee, praying, and has a great relationship with God. And here Lot is at the end of his life, and it's just, man, it's shrapnel. It's a destruction, and that's where it ends. So think about that, right? Lot never would have made that decision had he been able to fast forward and say, okay, that's the consequences. Maybe he would have went, oh, I don't think I want my life to end that way. But here he is, okay? So Lot's a great example of a guy that's trying to walk with God. He's got a foot in the world and a foot with God, and he can't figure out which one he wants more. And there you go, okay? So good reminder to all of us, because we've all got a whole lot of that in us, right? I struggle with the exact same things. I got a foot in the world sometimes, and I like what it has to offer, and I got a foot in the spiritual world, and that tension between my flesh and my spirit, constantly at battle, okay? So a reminder, all right? So chapter 20, let's move on, and we're going to see what feels like a repetition here, like we've read this before. Pick up in 20, verse 1, Layla. Okay, so lots of cities here. So where, what region is he in? 20 verse 1? The Negev. Where is the Negev? Good. Okay, all the way south, right? So this is where the tip of the Negev is Beersheba. Okay, that's the southernmost occupiable city in Israel, okay, where there's still water and you can have a city there. He is living south of there. Now, Abraham, we're going to see, he lives in Beersheba. That is his kind of his home base for most of his life. He's journeying south, which means what? What type of country is he going into? Desert, right? This is hard living, okay? In between Kadesh or Kadesh and Shur, okay, these are cities south of Beersheba in the Negev, okay? This is desert, okay? This is a pretty rough place to live. And he sojourned to Gerar. This was the same place, by the way. Who was headed to Gerar a couple chapters ago? Got kicked out of camp, pregnant, Hagar. Okay, so she was going to Gerar. So on the way to Egypt, okay? So Gerar would have been, some believe, to the west. It kind of depends. Anyway, but it's this is desert, okay? Now look who Abraham meets again. Verse 3. I'm sorry, we skipped verse 2. Read that. That's fairly important.
And Abraham said, Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And
Abimelech,
king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah.
Does it sound familiar? Like, wait a second, Abraham. Didn't you do that with Pharaoh? Like, haven't we had this conversation before? You're old in the town. There's a famine. Hey, you're my sister. I want to be treated well on account of my wife. So just tell the half lie. It's kind of true, right? They have the same, they're going to say it later, same dad, but not the same mom. Okay, so it's a half lie.
Is she like 100 now?
Yeah, she's 90. 89 or 90. Okay, so yeah. Again, wrap your mind around that. Like, oh my goodness, right? So, and she's past the point of childbearing. And Abraham's still concerned because she's so beautiful that, so yeah. There you go. Okay. Yeah, figure that one out. Okay, so, but same story, right? So this is, we've seen Abraham fail a couple tests. The last one was this, right? So this is like test two, take two. Hey, Abraham, you blew this. Okay, you failed. You went back from Egypt with your tail between your legs. Okay, went back to the last place you had fellowship with me, which was Bethel. I think it was Bethel. Built an altar, pray to me, confess. We're all good. Okay, I'm going to give you this opportunity again. Okay, I'm going to give you a chance to walk through the same situation and see how you do. How's Abraham do? Aren't you encouraged, right? This is the father of the Jewish faith. Here's a guy that's supposed to be the shining example. He's on every Bible cover. You know, I'm the hero of the faith. And he's a knucklehead, right? He still hasn't learned this lesson. And thank God that God doesn't record everybody in Scripture that's like, you know, Nehemiah or Joseph, and we go, man, I'm really looking hard to find a sin issue in their life, and I don't see one. Abraham had it, and you're going to see he's going to pass the same issue on to his kid. Isaac is going to be a liar, just like his daddy. And we're going to find out, this isn't the only instance. It wasn't just these two instances. It sounds like from the text, this was a habitual thing, that Abraham made a practice of doing this, and Isaac's going to say as much when he picks up this habit and says, well, that's what daddy did. Like, that's just kind of how we did it. When push came to shove, if you had to bend the truth ever, you know, so little to make things come out in your favor, that's what you did. So we're seeing Abraham, we're seeing his faith increase, but we're still seeing the same roots of sin in his life that you and I have. So in a really weird way, be encouraged. Okay, so he lies to Abimelech. Abimelech, by the way, is like it's a title. It's not a person. So think like Mr. President. Okay, we call our presidents Mr. President. We have a gazillion of them. It's a title. So Isaac is going to meet Abimelech, different Abimelech. It's like Pharaoh. Okay, there's lots of different pharaohs, but it's a title. Okay, so this is the same Abimelech from all that we can tell. Okay, so king of Gerar, so north of Egypt, in between where Abraham's living in Egypt, is Gerar. Okay, so God comes to Abimelech in a dream, verse 3, at night, and said, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman you have taken, for she is married. So God has to step in again, save Abraham's backside because of the decision that he's made. And Abimelech, again in this story, is going to be the more righteous of the two between Abraham and Abimelech. Okay, verse 4, Layla, keep going.
Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister, and she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have sinned.
How about this? He hasn't come near her yet, right? And he says to God, look, I am innocent in this. Like, I have got good motives. I mean, it's the wrong picture, right? The man of God is in sin. The pagan is the guy that's walking with God and doing things correctly. And he has a moral fabric about him. Abimelech does. It says, listen, I didn't know, you know, some moral fabric. I guess, you know, he has a harem, so take that for what it's worth. But Abraham's going to have multiple wives too, so sorry, Sarah. But yeah, so that's going to be part and parcel to the patriarchs as well. So he says, God, I didn't know, right? So I took a woman that I thought was unmarried, which God frowns upon anyway, obviously, this idea of harem. But God says in verse 6, yes, I know that in the integrity of heart you have done this, and I also have kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, this is a fascinating commentary to me, okay? Abraham sends his wife in to do exactly what potentially would have happened. By the way, we don't have Isaac yet. We have one illegitimate kid, right? What happens now if Abimelech takes Sarah into his harem and sleeps with her? Where did the nation come from? Now we have a baby. Is it Abimelech's baby? Is it Abraham's baby? Right, we don't know. Okay, so God stops the process. Now, obviously, there's a sense that that would have been a sin against Abraham, right? To sleep with another man's wife would have been a sin against Abraham. How does God state the sin issue in verse 6? It's against me. Talk to me about adultery. How does God view it? Is it a sin against the husband? Is it a sin against the wife? Partially, but in God's eyes, it's much bigger than that. It's a sin against me, because that is my institution. I created marriage this way, to be this purpose. God says, no, 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 that is a sin against me. Okay, so just a fascinating Old Testament commentary on how God views marriage and the marriage covenant. Okay, and again, that's why those words are so important, especially in marriage. You're going to see God, even in the midst of these patriarchs that have multiple wives, and we're going to see that all the way through even into David, God has a very, very high view of marriage, and unfortunately, we at times do not. Okay, it is a covenant relationship, and God says, that's a sin against me. Okay, so now therefore, he says to Abimelech in this dream, restore the man's wife rather, for he is a prophet and will pray for you and you will live. So, odd deal. First time, by the way, we see Abraham called a prophet. This is the first mention in Scripture of that role. God says, listen, he's going to pray for you, even though he's the guy that is kind of at the root of this and to blame. Apparently, God had shut down Abimelech's womb, or not his, but his wife's, and everyone in the town. So God literally shut off the valve of blessing to everyone in Gerar, okay, as a result of this action. And they knew it. They knew something was wrong. They just didn't know the source of it. So God says, Abraham's going to pray for you, and I will basically restore, end of verse 17, Abraham prayed to God. God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids so that they bore children. So forever, whatever length of period they were in Gerar, God had shut down the wombs of everyone there because of this issue. So God took this very seriously, okay? Now, the interaction between Abimelech and Abraham is interesting. They've got some history together, okay? So Abimelech now has this word from God. Abraham has no idea that he knows. And this is now Abimelech in verse 8 coming to Abraham saying, hey, dude, what's up? Read that. Okay, keep rolling.
Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done.
Wow. I mean, those are stinging, harsh words. What have you done? Like, what have I done to you that would cause you to do this to me? Like, again, the pagan shaking his finger at the Christian saying, your line of morality is lower than mine. Why would you hand... I mean, this is a harsh rebuke, okay? So Abimelech says to Abraham, what have you encountered that you have done this thing? Verse 11, now Abraham's going to respond, okay? Because I thought... Now listen to this, if this doesn't sound just like Eve in the garden. Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife, right? You see the rationalization of his sin? Nobody fears God here. I'm a foreigner. If I come in and they do what these people would normatively do, which is take my wife, kill me, I'm going to lose my wife. I mean, you see the logic in it, right? It makes sense. Fearful, I'm afraid, you're going to kill me. You can see how Abraham rationalized this to he and Sarah. Okay, and then he says, besides, verse 12, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. So she's my half-sister, okay, which is weird, but just roll with it for now. Okay, it's God's going to change the rules later, but I guess to populate the earth, there was some wiggle room at the beginning, okay, but don't go back there, okay. Came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that he said, this is the kindness which you will show to me everywhere. Everywhere we go, he said of me, he is my brother. So tell me about this deal that they had. This is the kindness which you will show to me. This is the conversation between he and Sarah. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. You get the idea that there's a habitual deal, that anytime they are outside of home base, right? Hebron, Beersheba, when they are outside of maybe their safety network in lands where people don't agree with them, the deal was, you're my sister, not my wife. Okay, so this seems to be a habit that Abraham just cannot kill. Okay, so interesting. Now, who's wronged who at this point? Humanly speaking, who's in the wrong? Abraham. So he should probably be the one to make it right, right? 14. Jordan, pick up there. Is that not bizarre, right? You sin, and you get lots of cool stuff in return, right? Here's my Honda Civic, and some money, and some whatever, right? And that's the story, because Abraham is a blessed guy. For whatever reason, that's how it went down. So Abimelech, in order to clear his conscience, or to say, look, so we know who's in the right here, ends up giving a bunch of stuff to Abraham, just like happened with Pharaoh, right? So he leaves town better than he came in. So you sin, you get more stuff. Okay, that's the lesson of the Old Testament. No. Okay, I don't know. I can't figure this out either, but that's how it was. Okay. So Abimelech says to him, behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please, meaning leave. Go somewhere else. Okay. We'll give you, you know, we'll have a good relationship, but you go settle somewhere else other than here. Right. Yeah, he's up against big kings with big numbers, and I mean, there's a natural fear in the midst of that. So, I mean, Abraham is he's a high roller. I mean, he's got money, he's got stuff, but he's just trying to politically maneuver every which way he can to make sure that wars don't start, and he doesn't want any part of that, even with a trained army, which he certainly had. Yeah, I doubt it. I don't know. But he had to have servants with him when he went, but there were probably people back home. So I don't think he's like taking the whole clan, but yeah, it's just an odd deal all the way around. So he says, basically, Abimelech says, love you, mean it, but you're not welcome here. So go settle somewhere else. Okay. We'll have a decent relationship. Like, we're going to sign a peace treaty. We're not enemies, but we're also not chummy. Okay. So we're not going to eat lunch today. Right. To Sarah, he said, verse 16, behold, I've given your brother notice that, I've given your brother, like, that was just a little punk, right? I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men that you are cleared. So I'm giving you money to say, hey, our relationship's okay. So again, it's kind of backwards, but that's how it rolled. Abraham prays to God in verse 17, and now all Abimelech's maids and his wives are okay, because in verse 18, God had shut down their wombs. And that's how the chapter ends. So bizarre picture again of the backwards roles.
Why is Abraham going to a different?
Yeah, we don't get the reason. I don't know. You know, before it was the famine. We don't get the reason here. Isaac's going to go down because of a famine. Abraham went down the first time because of a famine. So maybe the same situation was happening, which led him out of the land. It could have been water. It could have been their wells were dry. You know, we're going to see in 21 and following that he's going to dig some wells. So water was a prime issue. And if your well dried up, guess what? You're not living there anymore. Okay, so it could have been any number of reasons. More than likely, it was food or water related, just based on the land down there. So, okay, that's the idea. All right, and again, yeah, if you didn't have a well, specifically in this area, there is no 7-Eleven. There is no town nearby to go get, right? So you had to have, that would sustain you and your family, okay? So there you go, all right? 21. Melanie, pick up 21:1. Let's keep rolling from there.
The Lord visited Sarah, and he had said, as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised.
So now we're a year later. What is God doing to Sarah? Giving her a baby. Sarah conceived, verse 2, bore a son to Abraham in his old age and at the point in time which God had spoken to him. So God comes through exactly when he says he's going to come through. God is seldom early, but never late, right? So God, here he is. He shows up exactly what he wanted to. What does Abraham call his son? Verse 3, Isaac. Okay, I lied to you yesterday, by the way. Isaac does not mean God sees. It means God laughs. I'm sorry. So I totally botched that yesterday. My bad. Okay, Isaac means God laughs. Okay, the reason, I don't know why I wrote it down in my Bible wrong. Sarah laughed. Remember that story? And the angel of the Lord said, heard that. And she laughed to herself. So he said, you're going to name the kid God laughs. Okay, so Ishmael means God hears. Isaac means, it comes from the word laughter. That's the root word of Isaac. Okay, so he laughs or God laughs. Not God laughs. It just means laughter, okay, or laughing or whatever. So the root word of Isaac is the idea of laughing, okay, which again was just an idea from the angel of the Lord saying, no, I'm sovereign. I heard you, and this is going to be funny, right? So, and it's one of those stories, like, what did that look like when, and you'll see this the fleshing out of this in a little bit, but like, when Abraham and Isaac tell the story to their friends, I mean, what do you do but just sit back and laugh and go, I don't know. None of this makes sense. God did it. And you chuckle, right? And God, he's going to take, the angel of the Lord's going to take that lack of faith and a laughter of no way to, there's no way this happened, but now we believe. But and you share the story and laugh. And that's what Isaac means. There's no humanly speaking way that this kid should be around, and here he is. And God is faithful, and now Abraham has the kid, right? So his whole life, by the way, has been waiting for this event. He has been waiting now 25 years to get his kid, right? He's got one that's illegitimate that God says, okay, you had him, you're going to take care of him. By the way, you guys remember the gap between 17, end of 17 and chapter 18, verse 1 was 13 years? Why 13 years? Put your Jewish lenses on for a second. Why 13? What happens to a kid when he turns 13 in Israel? He's a man, right? The bar mitzvah. You are going to care for this kid until he is a man. Okay, and we're going to see now that Isaac is around, game changes, okay? It's going to be a very different picture with these two around, okay? So, Isaac is born, Abraham's 100, okay, verse 5. Sarah is 90, okay? God has made laughter for me, she says, verse 6. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. Like, are you kidding me that this happened? So, again, God stacks the deck against himself, and people go, dude, you've got an unbelievable God. And that was God's view in this. For him to get bigger, for her to get smaller, Abraham to get smaller, to increase their faith, and for God to show that he can do only what he can do, okay? So they laugh. Verse 8, the child grew, was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. A kid in Israel would be weaned, which means off of mama's breast milk, anywhere from 2, potentially all the way up to maybe 5. So they were breastfed maybe a little bit longer than they were in our culture. So Isaac is probably somewhere in that neck of the woods, okay? 2 to 5, probably closer to 2, okay? So he's weaned. Sarah saw that the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, verse 9, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. So now Ishmael's a teenager at this point, right? So he's 15, 16 years old, and he's punking Isaac, okay? And God says, okay, hold on, that ain't gonna happen, okay? Verse 10, she says now to Abraham, Sarah says to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac. Now, last time this happened and Sarah said, kick Hagar and the son out of the land, how did that go over? God said, that ain't going to happen. You bring them back in, you care for them for 13 years, you raise them until Isaac or Ishmael is a man, you take care of them. So Sarah has the same idea. Verse 11, the matter greatly distressed Abraham, right? because of his son. He doesn't know what to do, and he realizes, man, last time I did this, it didn't end so well. So I don't know if Sarah's advice is good or bad, right? He doesn't know what to do, okay? Verse 12, God steps in. Melanie, keep rolling there, and let's see what God says.
But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your offspring be named.
Okay, so one time he gets in trouble for listening to his wife. The next time God says, listen to her. She knows what she's talking about, okay? So God works through Sarah and says, yep, that's exactly what you need to do. Okay, now, but watch how they leave, okay? 13, I will make the son of the maid. I will make a great nation, just like he had promised. Abraham, verse 14, gets up early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, gave her the boy, sent her away, and she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. Okay, so they're in Beersheba currently in that area, in the Negev. Okay, he sends her with food. He sends her with water. Problem is, verse 15, the water in the skin was used up. The boy, and she left the boy under one of the bushes. The idea is they've journeyed for a few days. They are out of water. They are out of food, and they are on the brink of death. Okay, so is that what God wanted? Promising a kid, blessing in a great nation. Obviously, this isn't the chosen kid, but is that God's heart that this kid would just wither up and die with his mom in the wilderness? Absolutely not. Okay, verse 16, Layla, keep reading. Right, so here's what an awful picture. Like, I don't want to see my son die, like, but it's that bad at this moment, okay? And she's weeping. And verse 17, look who shows up.
And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar.
Isn't that cool? What's Ishmael mean? God hears, okay? And here she is. This is like take two, right? She's in the wilderness by herself with her son, weeping. Nobody's there, and she's on the brink of death, just like she was before. And God says, I hear you, okay? You're okay. What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up your head, and hold him by the hand, for I will make him a great nation. So even though he's not the promised kid, are those promises that he gave to Ishmael null and void? No, because God gave his word. He gave a unilateral covenant to Ishmael. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation. You're going to have a ton of kids. You're going to be the father of many. Okay, now you're going to be a pain in the rear to Israel, but you're going to be blessed, so you cannot die. So he says, chill, okay? Look what happens, verse 19. God opened her eyes, and behold, a well of water. Okay, exactly what she needs in the moment that she needs it. So she goes there, they drink. God, verse 20, was with the lad, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer, okay? We're going to find out he lives in the wilderness of Paran, okay? Paran, if you take the Dead Sea and you travel directly south, okay, on basically directly south of that area in the what's called the Arabah. It is probably the hardest living in all of Israel. It is desolate. It is nothing. And they live in an area south of Beersheba, south of the Negev, called Paran. Okay, in the Arabah, which would have been kind of just to the east of them, Ronan tells me that like average temperatures in July are like 120. Average temperature in July, 120. So miserable living. Okay, so this guy is he's a Bedouin. He's a desert dweller. They figured out how to live there, so they've dug wells. But it is hard, hard living out there. Okay, so again, these are desert people. Okay, so when you think of Abraham and Isaac and the like, Esau and all the people that are gonna come later, they're Bedouin. They live out in the wilderness. Okay, so you'll get a very cool picture of that when we go to Israel and you get to meet Bedouin. Okay, these aren't people living in, you know, Hume Lake and tents and wilderness and green and lush and rivers. And man, they are in a place that none of us want to live in. It is awful, right? And in Israel today, 70% of Israel is desert. 70% of the land. And it's not a big land, right? 70% of it is desert. They are trying to find ways to get people to go live in the desert with a lot of creative means. So the government is working really hard to get people to live there because it's uninhabitable. Okay, and if you can't figure out how to make life happen, again, nobody wants to live there. They want to live in Tel Aviv on the coast or in Jerusalem, up in the mountains or in the Shephelah where it's pretty and green, you know, most of the year. But nobody wants to live in the Negev, okay? And Ronan will tell you some really cool stories about some of their prime ministers and people that were really, really great leaders of Israel that kind of carved paths to help that. And now much more of that is inhabited than has been in like 100 years.
So would the other 30% be the area that's considered like the land flowing with milk and honey?
Yeah, so figure that one out. When God says the whole land's flowing with milk and honey, and 70% of it is, there ain't nothing. There ain't no milk, there ain't no honey, there ain't no water. Yeah, I guess so. So, but, man, they find a way to make it happen. So things were a little bit different, I guess, back when Moses rolled in the land, when they got grapes between, you know, their shoulders that they carry in. They're gigantic, but so things were bigger. It's like Texas. It's just bigger and better. So says the Texan. All right, so that's the picture. So God allows Abraham to say, yep, it's time. We're going to separate these two because I want to be clear on which kid is the kid of the promise, right? So Isaac and Ishmael cannot live together. They're going to separate, and God gives them the green light to do that. So God shows up, takes care of Abraham, takes care of Hagar now, as well as Ishmael. They're all provided for. God will not let this kid die, and he's going to bless them just like he said, okay? Now, 22 and following is kind of a picture of the relationship now that Abimelech and Abraham have, okay? They're okay, okay? So this is just kind of a cool story in terms of the rest of the story behind their relationship, okay? Pick up in verse 22 of chapter 21. Someone grab that. Phil Cole, I guess is how you say his name.
Phil Cole, the commander of his forces, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you do. Now swear to me here before God that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants. Show to me and the country where you are living as an alien the same kindness I have shown you.
Okay, now why would Abimelech be coming to Abraham and saying, listen, let's make sure we ratify this agreement. Be kind to me. Let's make sure that we've got a good relationship. Why would he need to do that with Abraham? Yeah, he fears Abraham and his God for sure, right? Why else? How's Abraham dealt with him in the past? A little on the shady side, right? So he says, hey, I've been kind to you. I expect the same in return. Let's kind of ratify this deal. And what does Abraham say? Verse 24. I swear it, right? We're gonna kind of formalize this agreement. We're gonna be drop dead honest with each other. And Abraham has a beef. Okay, there's an issue that's been under his skin that he now needs to talk about. Now, whether Abimelech had heard about this, he says that he doesn't, but something sparks this conversation. Okay, and this is a big deal. 24. Read that.
25?
Yes, that's what I meant. So when I say 24, you hear 25. Read my mind. So apparently there was a well that Abraham had and Abimelech's servants just took it. Now, this is a big deal, right? When you see some of these wells in Israel, they're deep, they're big. These aren't dug in like a day. They take months, if not years, to get water out of. Now, you dig a well and you get all the way down a couple hundred feet, right? Figure that out. And there's no water. What do? Let's dig another well, right? So it's not like you just... Here, perfect, dig. There's water. Like, you don't know. They start digging, and they hope that in there is water. And if you don't get water the first time, you keep digging. So Abraham has found water in the desert, right? And what happens? He finally gets it, and Abimelech's servants say, we'll take that. And Abraham says, do I want to fight, or do I want to? So he says, I'll back off, okay? So he says, okay, now that we've got this new relationship, Abimelech, your boys took a well that I dug. Abimelech says in verse 26, what's his answer?
But Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this. You did not tell me, and I heard about it only today.
So what's his answer? That I got no idea what you're talking about, right? So you're like, okay, so we got a new relationship. We're trying to be honest with one another. If you say that you had no idea that I dug this well and that your servants took it, okay, no worries. So Abimelech says, I don't know. 27, Abraham's response. Read that.
So Abraham brought sheep and cattle and gave them to Abimelech, and the two men made a treaty.
Okay, so what would the sheep and oxen be for? Yeah, potentially. Maybe to cut in half. They certainly make a covenant there. And then in verse 28, Abraham took seven ewe lambs by the flock by themselves, and gives them to Abimelech in addition to the other animals that they did. Now, whether they cut those in half or they were just a gift, I don't know. But Abraham is trying to communicate something very clearly, and Abimelech catches on. And he says in 29, what do these seven ewe lambs mean, which you have set by themselves? So you gave me this first round of stuff, and then you set seven more ewe lambs by themselves. What does this mean? And Abraham says, this is what it means. Verse 30. So what is Abraham concerned about? Yeah, maybe you don't believe me. Okay, so I'm going to give you seven more just so you know that I dug this well. This is mine. My integrity is important to me. This is my well. I dug it. You said you had nothing to do with it. Abraham is not like, you lying jerk. Like, okay, great. I'm going to pay you for the well that I dug, and then I'm going to pay you some more for the well that I dug. Again, it's backwards, right? So he makes sure that they realize, okay, we've got a good relationship. You've taken care of me when I wronged you. I'm going to take care of you when your people have wronged me. I dug this well. It's mine, okay? Notice what they call that place, verse 31.
Therefore, that place is called Beersheba, because they both of them swore an oath.
Anybody got a note on what Beersheba means?
Well of seven or well of
both. Yeah, well of the seven or well of the oath. We don't know which one it means. It has the idea of meaning both, okay? So they make a covenant there, an oath there, that that's Abraham's well, and they're going to ratify that, okay? So that's going to be, again, Abraham's home base. They're going to have that well, and they take an oath there. We will go stand in Beersheba, and you will see the well there, and you will be amazed at what a well looks like in Israel, okay? You know, you can spit in this thing and count. One, two, three, four, bottom. Like, dang! Like, that's deep. So think about old Joe that got thrown into a well, right? It's or a pit. It's a different, whole different story, okay? This is one of the deeper ones in Israel. Not the same well, but you'll stand in the town, you'll see it, and more than likely not the same well. Could be, but more than likely not, okay? So they make a covenant, right? He and Abimelech, Philcol, and they arose and returned to the land of the Philistines. Okay, so on the west side, Abimelech goes back to that direction. Okay, and then we read this verse before, but what does Abraham now do after buying this well? This is the first piece of property, not really even property, but the first thing in the land that he says, that's mine. What does he do? The tree. What kind? Tamarisk. Why is that important? It's slow growing. So what, and again, on the heels of what he just did, of putting a flag in the sand, why is that important? Yeah, and that's my land. That's my well. This is for my future. What has Abraham waited again his whole life for? Isaac, right? He realizes, man, I'm a hundo. Now, he's still got 75 years left, but he's about to die. He finally has the promise from God, and what is he thinking about? The future. I'm investing in the future. This isn't about me. I'm not going to enjoy the fruits of this tree. I'm going to water it. I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to have some land so that when Isaac comes, this is about Isaac. This isn't about him. Okay, so again, like Abraham, right? You see his faith maturing. You see him getting his eyes off himself, and he's thinking about, man, I'm going to set my son up for success, right? That's where his heart is. So he's finally got the promise fulfilled from God. Things are looking good. He's at peace with his neighbors. He has water. He can finally live. Has a hometown. Abraham, verse 34, actually end of verse 33, calls upon the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. So he's got a great relationship with God. Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. So he's in, again, the southern part of Israel, in Beersheba, in the Negev, at peace with his enemies. All looks to be great, right? Until chapter 22. And God is going to ask him to do the ridiculous. Okay, so how about this? 22:1. Somebody pick up there.
Now it came after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you.
What? You have waited 25 years for the one promise in your life that makes a hill means a difference. And God says, great, I did that. I waited 25 years. Now what are you going to do with your kid? Go kill him. Like, what in the, what is God doing, right? Bizarre. 22:1, make some observations for me, okay? What is this for Abraham? You see it in the text, verse 1. What is God doing? Testing him. Will you walk with me? Will you trust me when it's difficult? Is this going to be a you're my sister thing? Or are you going to trust me in the midst of this is your greatest possession? It's the thing that your life is most entrusted in. This is the thing that is most valuable to you, and I'm asking you to give it back to me. Like, man, this isn't the 1s, 2s, and 3s of difficulty. This is the 8, 9s, and 10. This is his kid, and God says, I want him back. Now, human sacrifice, unfortunately, in that day and age, would not have been rare. We're going to roll through all that with some of the pagan nations. So to sacrifice a firstborn son was often considered an act of worship to the gods that you worship. We're going to see this practice continued for a while with some of the pagan gods in the land. It is filthy McNasty, but it happened. So this would not have been odd. It would have been odd for God to ask it. Okay, so God is not a fan of this. But for whatever reason, that is what he's communicating to Abraham that he wants. Okay, so he says from the beginning, I'm initiating this. I am testing you. Okay, notice how he describes Isaac, verse 2. Take your son, your only son. Why is that significant? Does Abraham have another son? Absolutely does. What does God think about that other son? So what is it? Why is he saying that to Abraham? Why would that be important? I'm going to take your son, one of your sons. What is Abraham immediately thinking? No problem. Backup plan. Backup plan is Ishmael. I have another son. God says, we got one kid. There's only one that matters. Your son, your only son. Okay? So in case we weren't clear on who God thinks is the promised child, very clear, right? So he says, take him and you're going to go to the land of Moriah. Okay? Offer him there as a burnt offering in one of the mountains, which I will show you. Where is Moriah? Anybody know? Mount Moriah is in Jerusalem, okay? It is on where the current day Temple Mount is, okay? It would have been very, very close to Calvary, okay? Where Jesus was crucified on the cross, this would have been very close, okay? Now, the topography has changed a ton with Herod and some crazy stuff that guy did. It's a little bit different. But he says, go to Jerusalem. You're living in Beersheba. Travel to Jerusalem. I'm going to show you one of the mountains, and you're going to slay your son on Mount Moriah. Okay? This location, obviously, is very significant for a number of reasons. Okay? But don't let that detail skip you. You need to remember that. Mount Moriah, Jerusalem, definitely the Temple Mount in that area. Some people even say if it's not where Jesus was crucified or close to it, potentially where the Ark of the Covenant rests or would have rested within the temple, that this would have been very close to that or maybe even on that spot. So again, tons of significance. God wasn't random when he said, go here. He could have told Abraham, go anywhere, but he says, go to Moriah. Okay, so very, very significant act in his life. By the way, our third-born child, Ella Moriah, Sladen. Okay, that's where the name comes from, not Mariah Carey. So any of you that confuse that, curse you. But yeah, so significant in terms of this is going to be the highest level of sacrifice in Abraham's life. Okay, now, how does he respond? Verse 3.
So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had
spoken. What do you see in Abraham's life at this point? Total obedience. You're like, wow. You don't see pushback. You don't see him say, God, what the heck? Like, why me? What are you doing? I don't get it. He says, okay. And you got to think that Abraham's like, okay. Like, God, that's what you want. I don't get it. This doesn't make a lick of sense to me, but I trust you. He takes himself. He takes some servants. You see everything in there, right? He's clearly prepared to do this. He takes burnt wood for the offering, and they go, right? So here's Isaac, pops, some people traveling. Verse 5, watch what happens now next. Okay, so he has the young men stay, and now from whatever point forward, the two of them journey alone, okay, up to Mount Moriah. What do you think that journey was like? I mean, just if we slowed down and this got details, and you were to put this in a movie, right, what did that journey look like with Abraham and Isaac? Can you imagine the pain in Abraham, in the confusion in Isaac, right? You're going to see Isaac. I mean, he's not two anymore, okay? He's weaned. He's onward. He's a teenager. He's journeying. He's walking. This guy's at least 13, if not older. He gets it. He understands that something is awry in the situation. Can you imagine as a father knowing what you're about to go do and with full obedience and not sure what God's going to do, but this is what he asked you to do. Like he says, okay, this is what I want to do. Can you imagine the conversations that dad and son would have had at that moment? I mean, this is, love to see the scene in a movie, right? Amazing. Now, I want you to notice, put on your hermeneutical lenses for me. Make some observations in Abraham's comments in verse 5. Stay with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. What is Abraham going to do? Sacrifice his son. He's going to go to Mount Moriah. He's going to kill his son. What do you see in his words? We will worship and we will come back. Wait a second. He said, I'm going to go over and I'm going to kill my son, right? But we're going to return to you. Weird, right? Turn real quick to Hebrews chapter 11. This is pretty cool. Author of Hebrews makes an observation about the faith of Abraham. Okay? Here is why Abraham at this point in his life is an amazing dude. Okay? Hebrews 11, verses 17 and following. Okay? Read that.
By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of which it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him.
Whoa. So what is Abraham thinking at this point? Is God going to deliver Isaac? No. What is God going to do? He's going to raise this kid from the dead. What? Like, where did he get that idea? I mean, I don't know that we don't see that happen. That obviously is pretty, that's unnormative, right? That's not how God usually works. To our knowledge, we've never seen somebody raised from the dead, right? And God, Abraham says, look, I don't know. But if God wants me to kill this kid, and this kid is the promise, he is my only son, God's going to have to do something crazy miraculous, and he's going to have to raise this kid from the dead. He doesn't shy away from the act. Is that not amazing that the author of Hebrews would say that's what was going on in Abraham's heart? He wasn't half ready to do this. He was fully committed. Okay, so again, come back to 22. Let's see how this continues. Okay, verse 6, chapter 22. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac, his son. He took his hand on the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked together. So he ladens up Isaac with the wood on his back, right? So again, you get some cool pictures. The father's only son, the wood on his back, going to Mount Moriah, to his death, right? There's some really cool pictures of what's going on. And it's obviously meant to be that way. And then Isaac makes a very keen observation, verse 7. I have the wood, you have the fire. We're missing an ingredient. Where is the lamb? Who is the lamb? Isaac's the lamb. Isaac has not put the pictures together, okay? He doesn't understand what's about to happen, okay? And Abraham says, verse 8, God's going to provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. Now, who does Abraham know the lamb's going to be? You, right? He doesn't go to that extent to tell him. But Isaac's going to put the pieces together in a second, okay? So the two of them walked on together. Again, just the tension in that moment, like the father-son, like, whoa, that's got to be powerful, right? Verse 9, they came to the place which God had told them. Abraham built an altar, arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, and laid him on top of the altar of the wood. So he binds the sacrifice, which would have been how you did this thing. Isaac at this point is pretty clearly figured out. Oh, I'm the lamb. Okay. Yeah, Callie.
Do you think he, like, struggled against?
What do you think? That's a great question. Think so, but I mean he's a teenager, right? But you don't see anything in the text that says that he struggled. I'm sure there was some, Dad, what are you doing? What's going on? And trust me, I don't know. I'm reading between the lines a lot, but we don't see that. So we see an obedient son that, you know, according to the type and the picture of what this is, that is going to willingly lay his life down for the sake of the father, who says, this doesn't make any sense, but, you know, I want you to do that. So I don't think so. But yeah, just a crazy picture. And again, verse 10, Abraham stretched out his knife, stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. So he is in the full grips of this. This isn't he's waiting on God to show up. I mean, he is fully convinced, God, this is what you called me to do. I'm going to slay my son out of obedience, even though I don't get it. And if you are that big, then you're going to raise my kid from the dead. Okay, and in the very last moment, verse 11, read that. Mark, pick up there.
But the angel of the Lord called out from him to heaven, Abraham, Abraham, here I am.
Never so much if I wanted to hear your voice, God, right? Abraham, Abraham, why twice? We talked about that. What does repeating a name twice mean in Scripture? It's a sign of endearment. It's a sign of affection, right? It's saying, I know where you are. I know what you're going through. Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham stops in the moment of it. He knows his voice and he says, here I am. Verse 12, what is the observation that is made from the angel of the Lord? By the way, who? The angel of the Lord, okay? So here's the pre-incarnate Christ watching the Father's only son die on an altar, who is going to die on an altar in another couple thousand years, right? So what a crazy picture, right? Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Now, what was the beginning of this all about? What did God say the purpose of this was? To test Abraham, right? Does God know the faith that Abraham has? Does he know his heart? Obviously he does, right? But he's pushing him, putting him in places in his life of great difficulty to see how he'll respond. Now, again, I don't think it's a mystery to God that he's not sure how Abraham's going to respond. I think every bit of this was for Abraham to deepen his faith and to say, man, do I believe that God will do what only God can do? And sure enough, Abraham had to flesh this out. He had to go to the full distance and see. God knew how he would respond, but now Abraham knows, and that's kind of the picture, okay? So Abraham is obedient. He says, I know your actions. I know your heart. So, you know, 25 plus years later, we're now seeing a guy that is obedient. He is faithful. He's still got sin issues in his life, right? But he is a guy that we have watched his faith mature like wine over time. It's gotten better, okay? Abraham, verse 13, looks up and watch what God provides. How about that? Again, just instead of his son. You see the pictures there. So God just happens to provide a lamb that's caught in the thicket, and here the sacrifice is. Okay, so God names that place, verse 14, or Abraham names that place, God will provide. Anybody got a note on what God will provide is in Hebrew? Verse 14. Yahweh Jireh, Jehovah Jireh is the word that we get from that. Yahweh is the proper pronunciation of that. So Yahweh Jireh, okay, or Jireh. God will provide. So that is what that place will mean. And again, that's going to carry some pretty significance in the New Testament context of God will provide, because that is where we were provided for. Okay? Angel of the Lord called upon Abraham a second time from heaven, verse 16, and says, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you." Again, here comes the repeating of the Abrahamic covenant. "I will multiply your seed as the stars in the heaven, the sands that are on the seashore. Your seed shall possess the gate of the enemies in your seed, and the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." Okay? So we see the faith of Abraham again exalted. Verse 19, "Just as Abraham had predicted, Abraham returned with to his young men. They arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived in Beersheba." So they went and they returned. Abraham came back with a son in a way that he didn't expect. He thought God would provide in a different way, but here we go. Okay, so they return and they go back home. 20 and following, we get a little bit more of the fleshing out of the rest of Abraham's family. Came about after these things that Abraham, that was told to Abraham, saying, "Milcah has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz and Buz are his kids," right? 21. Yeah, so don't you just see those guys in like flannel shirts and an axe over it? "My name's Uz. This is my brother Buzz. We chop down trees." I don't know. Interesting dudes, okay? So we see the fleshing out of his family, of his brother and his now kids. Notice who shows up in verse 23. Bethuel became the father of Rebecca. Who is Rebecca going to be? Isaac's wife. Okay, so we'll see her in chapter 24. Okay, so she's a coming. Okay, Okay, so there you go. So a little bit more of their family, and she is introduced to us in chapter 22. Okay, so 22, if you want to paint just a picture of Abraham's life, that's the climax, right? That is the greatest test in his life, the greatest thing that he's going to call Abraham to do, and Abraham passes with flying colors, right? God help us if any of us are having to put in a situation like that. But man, Abraham was, man, you see why this guy is the father of the faith, and God asked him to do the difficult, all right? All right, 15 minutes. Let's see if we can get through part of 23 here and maybe into 24, okay? Now, again, we're thinking about now what's coming. Fast forward a couple hundred years, 20 so years later in 23:1, sad event. Go ahead, Layla. You
Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at
Kiriat Arba. Okay, that's Hebron, just another name. Kiriat Arba. Kiriat means hill. I forget what Arba means, but anyway, it's Hebron. Okay, so we're in the hill country. This is just north of Jerusalem. Okay, so we're in the land of Canaan, center, and this is where she dies. Okay? Okay, the Hittites are the sons of Heth. So Hittites are the people living in the land. Okay, now, your wife dies. She's from Ur, right? Normatively, where would you go hold the funeral and bury her? Home, right? You're going to go back to Ur. It's not what Abraham does. Okay, again, the promise, the land is significant. So he goes to these guys that are the current occupants of this place. So though Abraham has walked the land, and he's going to own it one day, he doesn't own all of it. So there are other people in the land. And he says to them, verse 4, "I am a stranger and a sojourner among you," right? I got a well down in Beersheba, okay? And that's about it, okay? And I argue with Abimelech and it's mine, but that, I mean, I haven't really purchased property. And he says to them, "Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight." Why is Abraham wanting to bury Sarah here? It's home. This is their new home. This is in the land. It's like dead central, right? So this is in the middle of the promised land, more or less. It's a place with hills and caves. That's where you would bury dead, up in caves. And the sons of Heath, or the Hittites, answer him and saying, verse 6, "Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us," meaning what type of reputation does Abraham have in the land? Dude, you're a big deal, right? And you're loaded. Okay, so yeah, you're a big deal. "Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead." So Abraham rose, bowed to the people of the land, to the sons of Heth. Okay, so they say, what's their response? Great, take what you want. Okay, verse 8, keep going. Ephron, Ephron, I don't know. Machpelah.
Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place.
So what do you see that Abraham already knows? Does he know exactly where he wants to bury Sarah? Absolutely. This guy owns this cave in this field, and I'm going to buy it from him. So go find Zach Ephron, right? And I want to buy his cave, okay? Sad that you all know who that is and are laughing, okay? I want his cave. So bring him out, and I'm going to purchase his cave for the full price. Why is that important? Keep going real quick. Verse 11, or 10. Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth. Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of all the sons of Heth. Verse 11, he says, "No, my lord, hear me. I will give you the field, and I give you the cave that isn't in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Go bury your dead." So what's Zach's response? Take it. It's yours. You're a big deal. You're a prince in the land. You want my cave, dude? Don't sweat it. It's yours, okay? Abraham says, "I'm going to pay you the full price." He says, "It's a gift." If you're Abraham, what are you thinking right now? Sweet. You know, that's free land. Perfect, okay? Not Abraham's response. Verse 13, he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, "If you will only please listen to me, I will give you the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead." Okay, so what is Abraham's response? No, I'm paying for it. Why? Ownership. I own this land. Who all is present for this conversation? All the elders, the whole city. They're watching this deal go down. He says, take it, right? Now, what happens later on if it was just this gift and, you know, Ephron says, "I want that back. Do you have a title deed? Do you have anything? Do you have any?" No, it was a gift. So Abraham doesn't have the permanency of ownership. Now, this is what's funny, okay? He says, take it. Abraham says, "No, I want to buy it." And he's like, okay. Verse 15, "My Lord," this is what Ephron says now back to Abraham. Listen to me, a piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Okay, now that doesn't mean 400 shekels of silver doesn't mean anything to you, okay? Here's what he says, okay? "You want my used 1987 Honda Civic. What's 1.5 million between you and me? Buy my car." You're like, excuse me? You want 1.5 million for a 1987 used Honda Civic? You can kiss my backside. That's exactly what he says. Like, that car is worth $2,000, and you want to pay me 1.5 million? Jeremiah buys a field in the book of Jeremiah for 17 shekels. He's asking 400, okay? David buys the threshing floor later on, for some sheep and oxen, and I think it's 50 shekels of silver. He is getting ripped off from the guy who says, no, just take it. Like, what is this guy doing? He's charging him an exorbitant amount. So Abraham's like, nope, it matters to me. So what does he do? He writes his check for $1.5 million, swallows hard, and says, fantastic. I own that cave. It's mine, okay? How big a deal is it to Abraham that he says, I'm going to bury my wife in the land in a cave that I own, that I purchased in the front of the entire community. It's mine. Like, that's a big deal. You see what he's doing? I have my son. Here is my seed. I have a little bitty piece of foothold in the land, but that's mine. I don't have from the Euphrates up north into Lebanon and down south into, I don't have any of that, but I have a cave. And that is where God promised. You see this guy's faith? He didn't care about the money. The money doesn't matter. He's loaded, right? Now, it hurt him for sure, but he's like, the heck with it. This is what matters in my life. So I've got land, I've got seed, and God's already blessed me. This is what matters to me. So he buys it. So he counts it out in verse 16. This was not a bad business deal for Zach. That's why he's so rich today and on all the TV shows. Okay, so he made a lot of money. Okay. By the way, you know what Machpelah means? Double price. It basically means you just bought the field to rip you off. Okay, so that's what it means. Okay. So you can go. We can't go, unfortunately. But the cave of Machpelah, the burial tomb of the patriarchs, is still there in Hebron. Okay, we can't go because it's Palestinian occupied and there's not a whole lot there. That's one of the sites in Israel that I would love to go see, just to go stand at the cave of Machpelah and go, okay, right?
They know the exact cave.
Yep, there's a sign when we go to the side of David and Goliath, Azekah, you'll see on the highway, there's a big cave that says burial tomb of the patriarchs, 15 miles that way, or kilometers. Like, dang it! But yeah. It's, you can get in and out of those areas, but it's a pain. It takes like an entire day to go see a site because, anyway, it's just, welcome to the weirdness of Israel. You're in the land, but some of it you can't go to. So, yeah, Melanie. It means double price. Where's my note? Yeah. He owns the cave and the field.
The area around it.
Yeah. Yeah. So he would have owned, an area. So with a cave in it. So crazy. That's it. At the end of Abraham's life, that's what he owns. Okay. A well in Beersheba. Okay. In a cave in the Hittite region in Hebron. Okay. So that's the idea.
How far away are they from each other?
Pretty far. The journey was about the same, so that he took with Isaac, that's a 3-day walk, okay, from Beersheba up to Jerusalem. It would have been past Jerusalem. So, yeah, that's southernmost portion in like a midway, maybe not even quite midway portion of the land. But yeah, he's staking his claim, okay? So, just a cool picture, okay? So he buys that. Anyway, verse 20, last verse of chapter 23, so the field and the cave that was in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site to the sons of Heth, the Hittites, okay? So they make it official, they deed it over, so some type of official document was formed. Boy, it would be nice if we could find that today, okay? That, you know, the receipt for that purchase, you know, to say that Israel has a right to the land and it's theirs, okay, that he bought it, okay? I just want you to put a pin in your Bible right here, okay? This site, this land, both Moriah, that Abraham sacrificed his son in this area, less significantly, but more significantly with the Mount Moriah piece. David is going to buy that piece of property later in the Old Testament, okay? That site is really, really, really important, okay? So Brad will get into that as we get into Israel to kind of a greater degree is why that's important. But this is a very strategic, obviously, portion of land, okay? So there you go. Let's pause there, okay? 24 is all about now. If you're a dad and you've got a son who has no wife, what is your greatest goal now in life? Before you can die, what does your son need? A wife. See also chapter 24. We're going to see how Abraham picks a wife for his son Isaac, okay? So that will be Thursday. All right, see you guys next week.